KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's necessary practice and a pleasure, but for me, let's start with the pleasure and catch the vision.
Let me stress, if you don't evacuate, you're just putting your own life in, you're not just putting your own life in danger, you are also endangering the lives of our first responders who may have to come in and rescue you.
I think it's the most powerful thing she taught me about dying is that reading is the opposite of dying, that that's how you remain fully alive.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in for Steve Scheer today. That's author Will Schwabe, you just heard. He formed an unusual book club with his mother while she battled terminal cancer. It's a conversation about loving reading and the difficulty of knowing what to say when time is really limited. That's coming up in about 10 minutes. But first, Hurricane Sandy is bearing down on the eastern seaboard this morning, as you just heard from that NPR News update. Sandy is still over 100 miles off the coast, but it's already forced the shutdown of mass transit, schools, financial markets. In New York City, Mayor Michael Bloomberg ordered the evacuation of more than 370,000 people in low-lying communities from Coney Island in Brooklyn to Battery Park City in Manhattan. The city has opened evacuation shelters at 76 public schools. And one of those people who's been evacuated is John Hockenberry, the host of WNYC's show The Takeaway. Hi, John.
Hi, Katie. As you said, 375,000 just in New York, but all up and down the eastern seaboard. It's closer to a half million people. And I happen to live in a neighborhood that's close to the water. We were evacuated 14 months ago during Hurricane Irene. When the call came yesterday, we knew what to do and packed up. And, you know, I'm broadcasting today from Manhattan, but my family is scattered around various areas of higher ground in the five boroughs. I've got two kids on high ground in Brooklyn, and the rest of us are in Manhattan.
Well, where is your home? What area?
We're located in a neighborhood called Red Hook, which is right on the water. It's actually the same setting as in the movie On the Waterfront. And it's a lot of old buildings. The building I live in is from the 1850s. It's actually an old cotton warehouse, a wood frame building with massive wood frame beams. It's seen a lot of weather over the last more than a century. And it's unclear. I mean, we all expect that everything will be fine architecturally in the neighborhood, but there are many areas that the streets are already underwater in front of my house.
Well, you mentioned evacuating for Hurricane Irene, too. Is this evacuation much different than what happened then?
I think it's different in the sense that it was much more orderly. Irene was, a devastating storm all by itself, but it served as something of a rehearsal for this. It will be a more sustained event. It may not reach the levels of intensity of certain parts of Irene, which was a Category 3 storm at one point. This will be a Category 1 storm when it comes ashore. And it will stay for a very, very long time, though, because it's being stalled by weather conditions both to the west and to the northeast.
Well, how do you decide what to take with you when you're not quite sure what will happen to your neighborhood?
Thank you for asking, Katie. We didn't even think about it. We just sort of piled into the car. In fact, this morning, my wife had to go and get breakfast stuff because we didn't even think about bringing breakfast food. We're staying in a hotel in Manhattan, so we're actually reasonably well supplied. But as far as, you know, vital documents, computers, valuables at home, we're just going to have to wait it out and see.
And what did you tell your children about why you're staying in a hotel?
Well, they understand. I mean, you know, the building that we're in has these big blast, flood, hurricane shutters on it. So it's built for the elements. And we face the Statue of Liberty and, you know, feel the wind in Red Hook all the time. So they understood that this was a big storm. And actually, tornadoes have whipped across our neighborhood over the past 5 years that we've lived there. So they understood what was going on. My two-year-old doesn't really understand anything other than room service and the fact that there's a lot of ice cream suddenly available. But the rest of my kids understand.
Was it hard at all to get a hotel?
Well, I mean, in my case, I was lucky because I'm broadcasting. I benefit from the fact that we have a very, you know, active contingency planning department here at WNYC at the radio station. But in general, yes, I think if you waited until late in the day yesterday, it was probably impossible to find a room. As we were checking in yesterday afternoon at about 6, it was already pretty chaotic.
Well, I think it's interesting you mentioned that you're broadcasting. So you're a person who's affected by the story. You've had to evacuate, but you're also a person who's covering the story. Does it give you a different perspective to be doing both?
Well, I think it gives you a perspective in the sense that, you're Google searching your own neighborhood while you're broadcasting to make sure that the building is still standing and there are webcams everywhere. But I think in general, New Yorkers stick together. There are a lot of people who are going to be suffering from this. Our family is very, very lucky, and I don't expect that a week from today we will be doing anything other than, you know, sighing relief that we're all, you know, safe. Who knows what the property damage is going to be. But I think in general, the real story here is whether New York and the East Coast of the United States has found itself in a fundamentally different climate cycle, that basically the frequency of evacuations is going to be increasing between now and the end of this century. I mean, we've been evacuated twice from our neighborhood in the past 14 months, and that certainly indicates that, you know, change is afoot here.
And who have you been talking to about that in your coverage?
Well, of course, you could talk to all kinds of climate scientists, and they will tell you that any individual event is too small of a data point to extrapolate any sort of climate change. But we've already talked with a meteorologist this morning who says that the patterns of stalling of storms, where a storm gets stuck by a high-pressure system in the northeast over Greenland, which is what we're experiencing right now, plus the dipping of the jet stream, which stalls everything to the west and concentrates the weather conditions onto the eastern seaboard, that anomalous event is likely to, number one, be the result of climate changes that are human-caused and is likely to continue at a frequency beyond what we've seen in the last 500 years.
Speaking with John Hockenberry, he's the host of The Takeaway at WNYC, and we play it on our KYW2 station as well. You can find more details online about that. John, let's go back to the way people are moving around the city right now. Your transit, I understand, is completely down.
Yeah, that was as of 7 p.m. yesterday. I was in Times Square yesterday at around noon, and it was a very normal kind of Times Square Sunday afternoon. Everybody running around. It was, you know, sort of a carefree feeling. But then as word got out that the subway was going to close at 7 and that the clouds moved in and it was fairly clear that something significant was going to happen, you really saw a kind of get out of Dodge feeling on the part of people who got on the subways. By the time I got on the subway at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, people were really moving. There was a frenetic sense of we got to do a couple of things and then make our plans because this is serious. And then after 7 o'clock last night, the city really began to show signs of shutting down. So this morning you saw a real ghost town in areas that would normally be packed with Monday morning traffic. And, you know, emergency vehicles are mostly what's on the streets right now. And, you know, now as the wind and the rain is significantly picking up, people are very much hunkered down. And this is a quiet city waiting it out. And of course, the schools are going to be closed for another day. So we're just at the beginning of this.
Do you think that people took it seriously, or did it take the clouds rolling in for people to actually start to feel like something was going to occur here?
Well, I think New Yorkers took this seriously almost immediately, and you could tell that by the impact on retail establishments that almost immediately sold out of batteries and water and prepared food and canned food, the kinds of things that you know, don't require refrigeration. The tourists in Times Square were caught a little clueless by everything shutting down, and there were crowds of tourists at the hotel as I was checking in who were asking the doorman, what do you mean everything's closed? Why aren't the restaurants open? As far as they were concerned, it was just a rainstorm. So it took a little while for the message to sink in. But I think in general, New York residents are really taking this seriously.
And what have you heard as far as the worst case scenario for New York City? Mm-hmm. In covering this.
Well, the worst case scenario, and we got to be really careful about this. They're talking 12 to 14 foot storm surges that will be at about 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time tonight. And depending on the power of those surges, I mean, the height of the water, you can just measure with a tape measure where that would come up on various buildings. But the power and energy in those surges is going to determine if it remakes the levees. If, for example, a part of the FDR Drive on the east side of Manhattan were to be destabilized, and that road would have to be closed for a long period of time. West Side Highway, similarly, will be determined by the energy of the storm surge that comes up over the Battery in lower Manhattan. And then the question of what happens in the outer boroughs, places like the Rockaways and then the fragile coastline of New Jersey. The worst case scenario would mean permanent and prolonged damage and recovery in those neighborhoods.
John Hockenberry is the host of WNYC's show, The Takeaway. Thanks so much for checking in with us. I'm sure we'll check in with you again, perhaps as the week goes on.
One thing I can say, Katie, it is wetter here in New York than it is in Seattle today.
I don't know. We're trying to rival you today, but yeah, you probably are right. All right. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Speaking of weather, we have clouds and showers and 57 degrees in the University District, working towards a high of 59 today. Forecast says cloudy, rainy, and breezy this morning, then just a chance of showers later today. Chance of rain this evening, then rain likely overnight, the low near 51. We're expecting clouds and rain tomorrow, heavy at times, tomorrow's high reaching 57.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield. Regents, your health, connected. Regents Blue Shield serves select counties in the state of Washington and is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
First responders all up and down the East Coast prepared for the approach of Hurricane Sandy.
We deployed 1,100 members of the National Guard, every kind of imaginable equipment that you could possibly need, Black Hawk helicopters.
I'm Steve Inskeep. We'll hear the latest on the storm and the response on the next morning edition from NPR News.
And that comes your way tomorrow morning between 5 and 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. It's 9:17.
Will Schwalbe is the author of the new book, The End of Your Life Book Club. He worked for years in publishing, most recently as the vice president and editor-in-chief for Hyperion Books. He's also a journalist, founder of Cookstir.com, and co-author with David Shipley of Send, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
So as a former editor and vice president of Hyperion Books, how would you describe the book you wrote?
I would describe the book I wrote as a book about the books I read with my mother when she was dying, that's really a book about the role that books play in our lives, telling us what we need to do and what we need to do in the world.
What did your mother have? Lay out the situation for us.
So my mother in 2007 returned from a trip to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and she was sick. And for a long time, they thought she had hepatitis, and it turned out she had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And that was finally diagnosed in October 2007. And that's the most lethal of all cancers. It very often kills people in 3 to 6 months, but Mom actually lived for 2 years.
And how did she take the news when she got it?
The news of Mom's cancer hit her and all of us like a thunderbolt. I mean, it just is, I think, the last thing anyone expects very often. And the news of pancreatic cancer is as bad news as you can get. But we were so immediately plunged into this other world that I think she was in shock, and I think we all were too.
You end up forming a rather impromptu book club as a way to, well, just sort of share in what you're reading, but also to give you something to talk about while she has to sit for those long hours getting chemotherapy treatments.
Exactly. We'd always talked about books all our lives, but now that I was taking turns with my brother and sister and dad accompanying her to her various appointments, she and I found ourselves with hours and hours at a stretch, and we talked about books. And very quickly, we realized it was kind of like a little book club.
Did you often read the same books?
We were the kind of family where if I read a book I loved, I would say to my mother, you must read this. And if she read a book she loved, she would say, you must read this. So we kind of insisted that each other read the books we loved.
You do a great job at chronicling and remembering what books you were reading. Did you keep track along the road of what you were reading?
I kept track along the road. And a couple months before Mom died, I told her that I wanted to write a book about her, about the conversations we've had, and about what we learned from the books. And her reaction was, oh, don't be ridiculous, sweetie. Why would you want to do that? There must be something else to write about. And then the very next day, she sent me an email, and it was a list in chronological order of all the books we'd read together.
So she was keeping track.
She was also keeping track, too, yeah.
Have you always been a person that writes down what you read?
I've always been a person who scribbles notes. My problem is I don't always scribble notes with dates on them. But I write notes at the end of almost every day, what I read, who I talked to, what I ate.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. Why do you do that?
I like it. I think it's a nice way of reflecting at the end of a day. And it's otherwise the days sort of blur by, but there's something very comforting about it. It's not really a formal diary. It's just scribbled notes.
And is that where you're keeping track of, say, different passages from books that, you know, you find interesting? This whole book is full of like different quotations from books.
I don't so much do that notes. I'm a big dog earer. Mm-hmm. All my books have little little dog ears, and yeah. So, and I have this system too, where if I want to dog ear consecutive pages, I do the top corner for one page, and then I'll do the bottom corner for the bottom.
Oh, very, very smart. Now that's funny because we were just discussing this, a group of my friends and me, about whether or not you should mark up a book. You know, and everybody has a very distinct opinion. Some people don't even want to bend the spine. For some people, dog-earing a page is, you know, the worst thing. And heaven forbid you underline.
Yes. I mark books. And one of the books that was the most comfort to Mom, she had this amazing book called Daily Strength for Daily Needs. And the copy she had of this book, it's a book with a Bible quotation every day and a little passage from literature, usually religious, for every day. And the copy Mom had was actually from the year she was born, 1934. And someone had underlined passages in the first six pages of the book that related to death. And there was something very talismanic about that. It was very powerful for her to have that copy. And so I think that's an example how underlining or dog-earing passes on not just a book, but someone's soul, someone's opinion of a book and how it affected them.
Yeah, one of the things, I wrote it down actually, one of the things that's underlined in the book, and I think in the book, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but that your mother underlined the passage that says, "For to know thee is perfect righteousness, yea, to know thy power is the root of immorality." Why do you think she underlined that?
I think that was underlined, pre-underlined. Trying to remember that one. She had a habit too of, she would leave that book open on certain pages that she wanted me to see, and instead of showing me the book, she would just leave it open on the coffee mm-hmm. table for mm-hmm. me, which was one of her methods of bringing passages to my attention. The other was, she had this thing where she would never tell me to read a certain thing. She would hand me a book with her finger in one spot and a finger in another spot, and I was to sort of see where to start and where to stop.
So if she left that page open, what do you think that verse meant to her?
I think that everything that Mom got from religion and life had to do with personal responsibility. She really was very adamant with herself that people consider how they behave in the world. And I think that spoke to her about that topic.
I'm speaking with Will Schwabe, who's the author of the new book, The End of Your Life Book Club. Let's talk a little bit more about who your mother was as a person. How did she interact with the people in her life, her friends and colleagues and her kids, of course?
My mother loved people. She was constantly with people, talking to people, checking in with people, and was happily surrounded with really everyone she'd ever encountered in her life. She did like plans, and she was a very organized person. And even long before she got ill, even a slight adjustment in a plan could be a big problem. I mean, if you told her you were coming at 11 and then you called and said that maybe you were coming at 10:30 instead, there was a certain sigh in her voice you heard, and she'd make it work, but clearly it had set things a little awry. So that was one of her characteristics. But part of it was she was just so busy. I mean, she was busy keeping up with her friends and her former students and traveling all over the world for refugees. So she was tightly scheduled.
And one of the things you highlight in the book I thought was an interesting concept was that your mother also thought that people could express themselves not by creating things, like creating new works, like writing this book, but that they could express themselves by what they chose to support.
Yes. Mom was a big believer as an educator and as a person that not everybody has to do everything. That you can love pottery without making pots, and that you can love reading without writing books, and you can love movies without needing to make them, and that actually, that everyone as a curator in their life had the ability to surround themselves with beauty, with magic, with wonder, just by choosing what they read, what they saw, what they experienced, that you don't need to do something to enjoy something.
And she really liked pots. That was one of the things she was interested
pots,
in.
She loved pots, pottery. She just loved it. She loved surrounding herself, and especially young potters. She was really interested in supporting young potters.
So if you had that one thing, like her loving pottery, what's your thing?
I'm a little bit of an addict when it comes to paintings.
Oh.
I love paintings.
Interesting.
And she did still in that same thing with me, which is trying with whatever little money you have to buy something from an artist at a moment when it can help them in their career, to seek out young artists and to be their first sale.
Mm, that's a nice concept. When you read books now that your mother has passed away, after doing this book club, can you tell what books she would have liked when you're reading them?
I can definitely tell what books. I mean, I probably would be wrong with one or two, but I don't think very far off the mark. I just read, for example, a book called The Headmaster's Wager by a Canadian author named Vincent Lam. And it's set in Saigon in the 60s, and it has wonderful characters and explains how a particular community, the Chinese in Vietnam, were affected by the war as they attempted to stay out of it. And that's a book my mother would have loved. I'm certain of it.
What is it about that book? What sort of things was she attracted to?
Mom was very attracted to great characters and to books with a strong moral sense, to books that were really about something. The only thing she didn't have any patience for were what she called silly books. And silly books were where the writing wasn't good, the characters weren't interesting, and it really wasn't about anything.
One of the people that we regularly have on our radio station is a woman named Nancy Pearl, who talks about different books that are coming out and kind of gives our listeners the insight into what might be worth reading and what might be worth skipping. And she has a very strong policy that, you know, there are so many books in the world. If you read the first 50 pages and you're not into it, put it away. You don't have to plunge all the way through. Do you have anything like that that guides you when you're reading?
Well, I actually have some of my best reading experiences have been books that I almost gave up at page 50. There's a novel called That Swim Two Boys by Jamie O'Neill. And someone had told me, make sure you make it to page 55, because at 50, you're going to want to quit. And at 55, it'll become pure magic. And in fact, that was the case. So I don't really have any rules. I try to give everything a really, really good, long read. I very rarely completely give up on books.
I know one of the things that your book does, because you talk about so many different books with so much passion, is it makes you want to run out and read everything that you've ever considered reading. What advice would you give people of how to seek out where the quality titles are instead of being sort of dumbfounded in a bookstore?
Yeah, well, bookstores, any great bookstore is an amazing resource. And Mom and I had certain rules for how to find books. One was staff recommends. We took them really seriously. If someone had bothered to put a little yellow sticky on a book and write something terrific about it, we needed to pay attention. And then I have one major superstition, which is if I knock over a book in a bookstore, I have to buy it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So any book I knock over, I buy, because I feel it's like the universe telling me, read this book.
Is there one in particular you knocked over you remember?
Well, over the course of Mom and my book club, I knocked over Somerset Maugham's Collected Stories, Volume 2. And which reminded me again that Somerset Maugham is, in my opinion, the best short story writer ever in the English language. And I never would have been reminded of that if I hadn't bumped into it at Vero Beach Book Center.
And did your mom read that book as well?
She read it also. And she had read stories by him when she was younger, but it was a complete revelation to both of us, again, what a master he was at short stories.
It can be difficult when a person has a terminal illness to know what to talk about. Do you feel like this book club made it possible for you guys to get over these kind of empty moments where you're just not quite sure what to say to each other?
The book club was a huge godsend in terms of that. I mean, one of the hardest things for me being with Mom during her illness was knowing or trying to know when she wanted to talk about really big things, faith, death, courage, and when she wanted to talk about anything but the really big things, those moments when she wanted to talk about her grandchildren or a movie or what we were going to eat. And books allowed us to kind of navigate that. It brought up all the big themes so she could segue into those topics when she wanted, but also we could go back to just talking about the book and the characters when we wanted to do that too.
I'm speaking with Will Schwabe, who's the author of a new book, The End of Your Life Book Club, and he also used to work in publishing, most recently as the vice president and editor-in-chief for Hyperion Books. These hard topics and bringing them up here and there, are you constantly marking time as you're going through this? You're reading one book after another, but you can't not be aware that your time with her is very limited. So is there a moment when you feel like we shouldn't be talking about books, we should be talking about these harder things, or I should be telling her things that I feel in my heart about her?
There was a moment, I mean, I never felt we shouldn't be talking about books because we always enjoyed it so much. And Mom was so alive when she was reading and talking about books. And it did lead to so many other conversations. But there was one moment a couple months before she died where I had this idea, and I think it may have come from the movies, that I should have this big talk with her. I should sit down and I should tell her what a wonderful mother she was and everything she'd done for me and how grateful I was. And I kept thinking, when is the right moment for the big talk? When is the right moment for the big talk? And one day was over and I was sure it was the right moment for the big talk and I just couldn't do it. And I meant to say at that moment, Mom, I just wanted to tell you I love you. But something totally different came out of my mouth and I wound up saying, I'm proud of you. And that's all I said. And it's kind of a weird thing for a child to say to a parent, but I'm really, really glad I said it.
How did she take it?
She, I think, was really, really pleased with that. And in many ways, it reflected the fact that our relationship had morphed over so many years from parent-child to still parent-child, but something else too. A relationship where she wasn't the only one who could be proud of me. I could be proud of her too.
This is a little bit of a sidestep, but who was David Rode to your mother? Can you remind us who he was?
Yeah.
And also how he's involved in your story?
So Mom, after her years as a refugee advocate traveling all over the world, I mean, she was in East Timor and Bosnia and Liberia, but she was also very frequently in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And while there, she met an extraordinary woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree, who had a phenomenal collection of 38,000 books on Afghan history after the Soviet invasion. And so Mom had met Nancy, and Nancy had a dream of building a library in Kabul. And Mom helped create a U.S. foundation to make this dream come true. And she roped into it a fellow named David Rode, a really terrific New York Times reporter. And in the midst of this whole thing, while he was researching a book, he was seized by the Taliban. And so over the course of my book, I describe Mom's just panic and despair at the fact that this young man, who she thought was so terrific, this great force for good in the world, this amazing New York Times reporter, was in this horrible place. He was a captive of the Taliban.
And you also talk a little bit about how, sort of off of Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, that for you, you had a little bit of magical thinking when it came to David Rode.
I did. Mom was so upset about David and so worried about him that I thought, if by any way, chance, shape, or hope David Rode came out of that situation alive, it would give Mom the kind of peace that she really needed before she left the earth, whenever that was. And through a complete and total miracle, David managed to escape the Taliban and make it back safely. And in fact, Mom met up with him about a week after he came back at the wedding of a child of one of her oldest friends. And it gave her an incredible sense of peace. It was like she and I had attached to David Rhodes' freedom a kind of equation that if he was able to get out, then she would feel sort of all right about the world as she was leaving it.
Did he know that you two had attached so much meaning to his freedom?
I don't think he knew until he read a draft of the book or the complete book. But he did know about her friendship and prayers because Mom had been in constant touch with David's wife. And David wrote the most wonderful letter to my mother, which is included in the book. And it's about comparing her battle with cancer to his captivity with the Taliban. And he winds up by saying that he wishes for her the same escape that he had. And that meant so much to her. She loved that letter.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about dying from your mother?
My mother had a lot to teach me about dying. She taught me, first of all, that no one's situation is the same. She felt very lucky because she'd made it to a certain age. I mean, she was only 75, which is very young, but she was pleased that she'd made it to that age. She felt very lucky because she had wonderful health care, and she realized that so many people don't have that. She had children and grandchildren. So she taught me that really to appreciate what you have, but not to assume that because you can appreciate it, that other people have been dealt the same cards. And she also taught me to live every day until you die. And that's what the reading really was. When we were reading, we were learning things. We were discovering new authors. It was an adventure. And so I write in the book, and I think it's the most powerful thing she taught me about dying is that reading is the opposite of dying. That's how you remain fully alive. And if you love to read books and can do it to the end, if you're lucky enough, then that's really a big gift.
I'm speaking with Will Schwabe about his book, The End of Your Life Book Club. Maybe just to end, can you bring us up to date on how your family has been doing in the years following this?
So the family, I mean, I think Mom did a lot to lay the groundwork for everyone to do very well. I mean, she, in her inimitable way, thought of every detail. One of the last things she said to me was she divvied up her frequent flyer miles, who would get Delta, who would get American, who would get BA. And she was so thoughtful about her death that she helped us with the transition to life without her. So, I mean, everybody was sad. We all miss her. We think about her. We talk about her. But it's one of really her last gift to us was the gift of helping us with the transition.
So is there any, for anybody who actually has a friend or a parent or a child or anybody in their life that has a terminal illness, just from going through what you went through, do you have advice for people who are kind of struggling with what to do in that situation?
I mean, one of the best things was a book we found. There's a book called The Etiquette of Illness. And I realized as soon as we were into this that I didn't know what I was doing and that many of my instincts were wrong. And we discovered this wonderful book, and it taught me a very simple thing, which was instead of saying to Mom, "How are you doing today?" I learned to say to her, "Do you want to talk about how you're doing today?" Which left the control in her hands. And that book was an enormous help to us. So, you know, I would never presume to tell anybody how to handle their situation, but I would highly recommend that they look up this book, The Etiquette of Illness.
Will Schwabe is the author of a new book, The End of Your Life Book Club. He used to work in publishing as well as the vice president, editor-in-chief at Hyperion Books. He's also a journalist and founder of Cookster.com, which is a cooking website, and co-author of another book with David Shipley called Send, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better. Thanks for coming in and taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:39. I'm Andy Hurst. Harvard biologist George Church says the day may come when scientists can make humans resistant to all viruses, resurrect woolly mammoths, and even use bacteria to grow houses. That's right, grow houses. Comedian Stephen Colbert asked him this.
How do you think your work will eventually destroy all mankind?
We'll get the answer to that question and learn more about synthetic biology. George Church talks with KUOW's David Hyde this afternoon at 12:40.
Support for KUOW comes from the Bush School, where students are challenged to reach beyond the conventional expectations of learning and use their education to make a difference in the world. K-12 open houses in October, November, and January. More information at bush.edu.
Clouds and showers in Seattle, 56 degrees right now in the University District. Working towards a high today of 59, forecast calls for clouds and wind this morning, showers as well. Tapering off to just a chance of showers a little bit later today. There's a chance of rain this evening, rain likely overnight, the low near 51.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Neighborhood Clinics. UW Neighborhood Clinics is a network of primary care clinics with 9 locations around the Puget Sound area. The clinics offer primary care services from pediatrics to geriatrics. More information is available at uwmedicine.org.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Let me ask you the opposite of a serious question. How silly a person would you consider yourself to be? If you just thought in your head, not very silly, then I want to ask you the question, well, should you be more so? And what does silliness have to do with art? Should you become a more expressive or creative person than you actually are? Well, joining us to talk about it is Carla Sondheim. She's a drawing instructor and illustrator based in Seattle. She's also the author of Drawing Lab for Mixed Media Artists. And her latest book is The Art of Silliness, a book of creativity for everyone. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So I was asking you before, during the break there, what's the silliest thing that you've done recently?
Yeah, I was actually kind of stumped because, you know, I'm supposed to be the silly queen, right? But actually, I think the silliest thing I've done recently is go to see the Addams Family musical last night. And even though I wasn't actually being silly, I was sort of partaking in the silliness of the show. And it was a wonderful, wonderful show, especially Uncle Fester.
Oh, really? Well, we'll have to go check that out. I guess that begs the question, like, is you don't have to be silly all the time to have a silliness to you.
Oh, of course not. actually, I'm a pretty serious person. I think you need to move through life reacting appropriately to different situations and everything. I think that what I'm trying to do with the drawing and the books, with the art of silliness, is just to remind us that there's a part of us that is childlike and silly. And it's just like, you know, there's a balance to everything, and some people might be more heavily weighted on the serious side or the silly side, but all of us have both components, and there's no reason to sort of, you know, just shut one of those away. I think that they both work together to make a whole person.
Well, what does silliness, or even that sort of freeness that you're talking about, of being able to move back and forth between the two, have to do with art, in your opinion?
Well, for me, it has everything to do with it. it's like anything. You trying to learn how to drive, or you're trying to learn a language, and if you seize up and become too tight with your expectations, you tend to do a lot worse than if you could relax and sort of go with the flow and enjoy what you're doing. And so the silliness aspect for drawing for me is a window into enjoying what I'm doing. And the more I can enjoy drawing, the more successful I will be.
So. I was watching an interview that you did online where you talked about that sometimes people feel like if they can't draw something realistically, or if, you know, they consider themselves not a good drawer, then they feel like they just shouldn't do it at all.
Yeah. I'm hoping to sort of person by person change that feeling. I think that's akin to saying that you shouldn't ride a bicycle unless you're good enough to race in races, or you shouldn't cook a meal unless you're a chef. there's many different ways of approaching drawing. Realistic drawing is one of them, and a very wonderful one, and one I do myself to support my stylized drawing, but it's not the only way to approach drawing. And I really am sort of on a mission almost to remind people that drawing is fun.
Well, why though? Like when it comes to cooking, we have to make ourselves food, right? Or we'll die. I guess we don't have to. We could go buy food. But, you know, cooking is something that people do out of necessity. Why should people be drawing?
That's a good question. I think there's not really a perfect answer to that. I think that the most true answer I can think of is that we, as children, that was one of the first things we enjoyed doing, is making marks on a page and delighting in, you know, the little figures or circles or scribbles that you can that you made. And I just, as an adult, I can't imagine that was just not important. It seems like we should be embracing the things that were important to us as children, as well as the things that are, you know, the serious things that are part of our lives now. And there's room for silliness.
Yeah, right.
There's room to tap into that childlike part of you that enjoyed, you know, absurdity and things that just didn't make any sense in the real world.
So maybe we should try something. Maybe we should have everybody try something.
Okay.
So unless you're driving a car, grab a piece of paper and get a pen ready. We'll give you a couple minutes here. Not a couple minutes, a couple seconds. Grab a pen, paper, and let's just try something simple to get people started. And those of you who think you can't draw, I'm talking to you. So get out your pen, get out your paper, you know, hunch down in your cubicle so nobody can see what you're doing. what should we try?
Okay. I was going to have you do a blind contour of a chair, but I've changed my mind just sitting here, and I'm going to have you do an exercise out of Drawing Lab, my first book, and that is a Picasso dog. And so what you need to do is draw an eye anywhere on your paper.
Okay, drawing an eye.
Don't worry about what it looks like, and it doesn't have to be too detailed at this point. Then turn your paper 90 degrees and draw another eye three times as big as the first eye on your paper, anywhere on the paper.
Okay.
Once again, you don't have to worry about it looking like a dog. Just sort of forget that it's even a dog. Just follow the prompts. And once you get that second large eye in there, turn your page 90 degrees clockwise and draw a nose or a snout.
Now, does it matter if the nose is facing the right way? Or
I give you the instructions, and then you guys can interpret them however you like.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So it's sort of like, you know, lots of freedom within the parameters.
All right. So we got a snout.
Got a snout.
So we can choose to put whiskers on or not.
Sure.
Okay. All right.
Once you have your snout, turn your paper 90 degrees clockwise and draw a paw or a foot.
Oh, man. No, feet are always hard. Let's see. Okay. I've got my paw.
And then turn your paper once again and draw an ear.
Oh, man, I don't know about you guys, but my dog is looking pretty strange here. Okay.
And then the last step is to turn your paper in all directions if you need to and find the orientation that speaks to you the most, and then just finish your dog. That could include adding another ear or paw. It can include just connecting the lines. You may have a complete abstract drawing right now and don't know what to do with it. Well, just leave it. Maybe it's done just how it is. So the last step is just to finish your dog.
All right. I just put a collar on my dog. That's what I did. Just to identify it as a dog instead of a cat or mouse.
It's very cute, and I'll throw it up on my website if that's okay with
yeah,
me.
Yeah, that's fine. You can put it on our Facebook page, too. Oh, that's good. So why do something like that with adults where you do it step by step by step?
I think that assignments and parameters help encourage creativity. When you face the blank page, it's just paralyzing. And I've been drawing for 20 years. I started late in my life. I was about 30 when I started drawing, and the blank page just completely paralyzed me. And so it helped me so much to start to come up with little assignments and problems to solve that could get me started. So that's the point. Hopefully, once somebody does this dog exercise, you know, they'll take it and add their own silly take on it and completely spin off in their own direction. And that's, you know, hopefully what everybody will do.
Well, if you just did it and you want to send us a picture, email it to us at weekday@kow.org. Perhaps we'll put some of the best ones up on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW if you want to search the Facebook page for it. And you could also, if you don't have a camera, just send us a couple word description of what your dog ended up looking like. That could be kind of fun too. So you mentioned just a second ago that you didn't start drawing till 30. That's and here you make your living as an artist.
I know.
So how did that happen?
Well, for me, it was a series of getting and working jobs that I found out I didn't like to do. And I kept, I started out as a legal secretary, and then I went into editing, and then a little bit of writing. And then I went to graphic design. And finally, I decided that what I really, really, really wanted to do was be an artist. So it's kind of like I had the impulse in high school, but I just didn't have the confidence to move in that direction, nor a mentor that could show me that there is actually a possibility to make your living this way. And so it just took me a while to find my way. But I think I came back to what I always wanted to do in the first place. And I'm happy to be here.
Speaking with Carla Sondheim, she's a drawing instructor and illustrator based in Seattle. And we're talking about her latest book, The Art of Silliness, A Book of Creativity for Everyone. And it's a book of worksheets. You talked a little bit about how scary the blank page is. So why a bunch of worksheets for adults?
Well, once again, we're trying to tap into that childlike joy of drawing. And I just, when I came up with the idea for The Art of Silliness, I just remembered how much I enjoyed doing worksheets when I was in grade school. And I don't know, it was a risk, but I just thought, well, I'll just put it together and see if anyone else responds to it. And I kind of went with the idea, well, if I think it's cool, maybe somebody else will think it's cool. So,
and in this book, you've created an entire different world or a different lingo. And what is it and where does it come from?
Well, that kind of emerged organically. I started The Art of Silliness with an online class in 2010. And one of the first assignments I gave was to make up some fleep words. And fleep was a word that it was one of those codes that I had to type in to leave a comment on a blog. So it was just very serendipitous, you know, fleep. And that's F-L-E-E-P. And the people that were in the class just sort of... they were so creative and so wonderful. They just went wild. And so we eventually have, you know, all kinds of made up nonsense words. I'm called the Squeen, which is, you know, kind of silly, but it's Silly Queen. So, you know, we have, it's just silly and it's not for everybody, but it does sort of, it's just one more trick or tool to make it fun and try to get yourself out of your normal way of looking at drawing, which might be a little bit too serious.
Has drawing changed how you see the world?
Oh, completely. I'm sort of a nut for drawing. So for me, drawing is basically the way in which I experience my world. And everything I've learned from drawing seems to translate into every other area of my life. For example, you know, you move through a series of drawings, and not all of them are, you know, most of them are fine and good, but not all of them are just that special one. And it might be sort of, you know, akin to your dating experience where you move through several or more guys, and then you finally find that one. So, and then, you know, you don't keep dating other men, but you keep trying, you know, new drawing, trying to get that next, good drawing. So,
well, one of the things you say at the end of the book is that you give us permission to dislike some of the assignments.
Oh, for sure.
And I must say that I was actively avoiding certain ones.
Yes.
So,
which one were you avoiding?
Anything that had to do with realism.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah.
Because both Steve and I are big doodlers, and we tend to doodle on the cartoonish side.
Yes.
Of things, or more design type side of things. So trying to draw a person's face is not something that I like to do.
I understand. And I think often what happens, at least in the class situation, and we'll certainly see how it is with the book, you know, I'm sort of handing them these worksheets one after another, and they're getting into a space where they're trusting that everything's for a reason. And so I've had a lot of students who were very trepidatious about those drawing assignments be very amazed and delighted at how well they did once, because all of your drawing, your doodling, your cartoons, all those are skills that translate into realism as well. And you already have it in you. It's just a little hill you need to get over.
Well, I can do animals.
Yeah.
But I can't do people.
Well, if you can do animals, you can do people.
But why give us permission to dislike some? Is that to keep us from being discouraged if we find that, you know, doing a Picasso dog is not for me?
Oh, no, it's not to... There is a little bit of that, but I think it's mostly that we're trying to... You are you. Every person is different, and every person responds differently to different things. And we want you to find the things that you respond to the most. And if you're, you know, just not interested in drawing buildings, and yet you have this semester-long, you know, class that you have to draw buildings, it's not going to, you know, feed your soul. So I'm really trying to get people to find out what they like. And some people like to be very neat. Some people like to be very messy. People who think that they're neat, if I give them charcoal, suddenly they realize that they like to be messy and they didn't know it. The reason I have you try all these different things is so you can start to get a feel for what it is you respond to the most. But basically, I'm hoping that people will, you know, find their own way with drawing and find the ways of drawing and the medium that speaks to them the most. Because that's the point, is to enjoy it.
And to find a reason to do it, right?
Yeah.
Carla Sondheim is with us. She's the drawing instructor and illustrator based in Seattle. And she's we're talking about her latest book. It's a workbook of drawing activities for adults called The Art of Silliness, a creativity book for everyone. Well, just in case anyone's feeling inspired, let's give everyone an activity assignment for the afternoon.
Okay. This one is called Blob Hunting, and I can't remember if I made up the word blob, but I don't think so because it seems to be popping up all over the place. It's basically just a random shape. And so the assignment then for you to do is to go outside. And if it's too rainy, you can go inside and look all around you. I'm going to talk as if it's outside because you can find more blobs that way. You can look on the ground and see leaves. You can look at puddle shapes, oil stains on the driveway, brick marks, all kinds of things. And just take your pen and draw the shape that you see. And you don't have to know what it is. And it doesn't even have to be an accurate drawing. Just do your best to draw the shape you see. So you basically have sort of a lumpy circle. And then go back inside into your kitchen table or whatever and take that piece of paper and turn it all around 180 degrees, 360. See if you see a face or an animal or a house or a shoe or anything in there. I tend to find animals. Some people tend to do faces and some people don't see any of that. If you don't see any of that, ask a friend to help you, a spouse or your child, or just add an eye somewhere and see where that takes you.
So we're creating something out of the blob that we find outside our house.
That's right.
Or inside our house.
Yes.
If it's pouring rain this afternoon. That's a great idea. All right, I'm going to try it. And if you try it, I want to see your drawings. So email them to us, weekday@kuow.org. Carla Sondheim is a drawing instructor, illustrator in Seattle. You can find a link to her website and her blog at our website, kuow.org. Her latest book is The Art of Silliness, a book of creativity for everyone. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. That's the sound of 16 sheep at supper time, all gnashing away, trying to eat as much as they possibly can before the others do. Weekday listener Gene Patrick Luce sent that sound to us from his small farm, which is called Harmony Fields in Bow, Washington. He says that in these colder, wetter, darker months, the grass just doesn't grow fast enough to keep up with the appetite of his sheep, and so they feed on the hay from the local feed store. Dean also says that even though he names his sheep, he is not above eating a good lamb chop from time to time. And he's also been selling the meat at the Kirkland Farmers Market all summer, so perhaps some of you have also tried some of Dean's meat from these sheep. These sheep are all still currently alive, but thanks, Dean, for sending in that sound. We've had some really good sheep sounds on this show. What interesting sounds are you hearing? You don't have to be on a farm to send us a sound. We did get a few great ones that we're going to play throughout the week from the weekend. People picking apples and rowing in boats and trying to get the their fall activities on. So if you're making an interesting sound in the world, record 30 seconds of it, send it to us along with the story behind it, and email it to weekday@kow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. More Weekday coming up. I'm Katie Sewell.
It's a minute before 10. Stick around for NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Eastside Prep, a co-ed independent school in Kirkland that inspires students to think, act, lead, and innovate, serving grades 5 through 12 with an average class size of 14. Next open house is on November 3rd. Information online at eastsideprep.org.
October 30th, 1938.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Government Meteorological Bureau has requested the largest...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.